A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about thinking, which I suppose is what thinking does best. We did a whole episode earlier today on cognition and how thoughts emerge, but now he's zeroing in on something more specific. That voice in your head, the one that narrates your life, ask what to drink from the fridge, sometimes races, sometimes goes quiet during meditation. He wants to know how differently people experience that internal monologue. Not the clinical cases. Not schizophrenia. Just the regular population walking around with thoughts floating through their brains every day. How does it actually vary from person to person?
This is one of those questions where the more you dig, the stranger it gets. And I love that. By the way, quick note, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V4 Pro. Back to the mystery of the talking brain.
Appreciate the efficiency. So where do we even start? I've heard people say they don't have an internal monologue at all, and my first reaction was, that can't be right. That's like saying you don't have a pulse.
That was my reaction too, and it turns out we're both wrong. Russell Hurlburt, a psychology professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, has been studying this for decades. He developed something called descriptive experience sampling. Basically, he gives people beepers that go off at random intervals, and they have to record exactly what was happening in their mind at that moment. Not what they think was happening, not what they remember 10 minutes later, but right then.
Instead of asking people, do you have an inner voice, which is already a question loaded with assumptions, he's catching thoughts in the wild.
And what he found is that inner speech, actual words running through your head, only happens about 20 to 25% of the time for most people. It's not the default mode. The rest of the time, people are doing what he calls unsymbolized thinking.
That's a mouthful. What does that actually mean?
It means you're having a thought. You know you're having a thought, but there are no words, no images, no symbols attached to it. Know the thought. It's like the thought exists in some pre-linguistic form, and your brain processes it without needing to translate it into language.
I'm trying to notice whether I do that right now. But the act of noticing is probably ruining the experiment.
That's actually one of the biggest challenges in this research. Hurlburt calls it the observer effect. The moment you try to observe your own thoughts, you change them. It's like trying to see what your face looks like when you're not looking in a mirror.
We have this taxonomy emerging. There's inner speech, the talking voice. There's unsymbolized thinking, which sounds almost mystical.
He's identified 5 main phenomena. Inner speech, that's the one everyone thinks is universal but isn't. Inner seeing, visual imagery in your mind's eye. Feelings, emotional states that you're aware of. Sensory awareness, noticing a sound, a bodily sensation, a smell. And then unsymbolized thinking, which is the hardest to describe and the one most people don't realize they're doing.
The one most people don't realize they're doing. That seems like the headline here. We all assume our own mental experience is the default human setting, and it's not.
And the variation is enormous. Some people have inner speech almost constantly. Some people have it maybe 10% of the time. Some people report none at all. And when I say none, I don't mean they're incapable of language or thought. They just don't experience it as a voice.
When someone says, I don't have an internal monologue, what are they experiencing instead?
This is where Hurlburt's work gets really granular. He studied a woman who insisted she had no inner speech. When the beeper went off, she'd report things like, I was thinking about whether to take the umbrella, but I didn't say anything in my head. The thought was fully formed, the decision was made, but there was no linguistic intermediary.
That's unsettling to me. I can't imagine making a decision without talking myself through it. Should I take the umbrella? Well, it looks cloudy, but I'm only walking 2 blocks. But I'm wearing a nice shirt. That whole negotiation happens out loud in my head.
That's exactly the kind of variability we're talking about. Some people's inner speech is dialogic. It's a conversation with themselves. Other people's inner speech is more like a monologue, a running commentary. Some people's inner speech is condensed, just keywords or fragments rather than full sentences.
Condensed inner speech. I think I do that when I'm rushing. Instead of, I need to go to the store to buy leaves for dinner, it's just store, leaves.
And some people's inner speech is what psychologists call expanded. Fully grammatical, complete sentences, almost like a prepared speech. The variation within inner speech alone is vast before you even get to people who don't have it at all.
There was a piece that went viral a few years ago, maybe 2020 or so, where someone posted on social media that they just discovered other people actually hear a voice in their head. And the internet collectively lost its mind because half of people were saying, wait, you hear a voice, and the other half was saying, wait, you don't?
That was a real moment. It exposed how little we talk about the actual texture of our mental experience. We assume everyone's inner world works like ours because we've never had reason to compare notes. It's like if everyone saw colors differently, but we all learned to call the sky blue, so we never realized some people's blue is what others would call red.
Except with thinking, it's even harder to compare because there's no external reference point. At least with color, we can point at the sky.
And this connects to something Charles Fernyhough at Durham University has been working on. He's the author of a book called The Voices Within, and he studies what he calls inner speech from a developmental perspective. His argument is that inner speech develops from external speech. The way children talk to themselves out loud while playing eventually gets internalized.
The four-year-old narrating their toy dinosaur battle is essentially running the beta version of what becomes the adult inner voice.
Lev Vygotsky, the Soviet psychologist, proposed this back in the 1930s. He said children go through a stage of private speech, talking to themselves out loud, and then that speech goes underground, becomes internalized. The structure of inner speech, according to Vygotsky, is different from external speech. It's more abbreviated, more predicative, meaning it drops the subject and just keeps the comment.
Drops the subject and keeps the comment. So instead of, I am hungry, the inner speech version might just be hungry.
And that abbreviation happens because you already know the subject. It's you. You don't need to keep reminding yourself who's doing the thinking. The inner voice is efficient in ways we don't consciously notice.
Which makes me wonder about the people who say they have no inner monologue. Are they actually lacking it? Or is their inner speech so compressed and rapid that they don't recognize it as speech?
This is the huge methodological challenge. When Hurlburt does his beeper studies, he has to train people extensively just to recognize the different forms their thoughts take. Most of us have never been trained to introspect at that level of detail. So when someone says, I don't have an inner voice, they might mean, I don't have a voice that sounds like a narrator reading an audiobook. But they might still have fragmentary verbal thoughts, they don't count.
Then there's the question of whether the inner voice has. Does it have a tone?
Some people report their inner voice sounds like their own voice. Some people say it's neutral, no particular sound quality. Some people have multiple inner voices with different characteristics. And this is still within the normal range. We're not talking about dissociative identity disorder or anything clinical.
Daniel specifically asked us to box off the clinical stuff, and I think that's smart. The normal variation is weird enough on its own.
It really is. Fernyhough's research has found that about 20% of the general population report some experience of hearing a voice that isn't their own in a non-clinical context. This could be the voice of a parent giving advice or a critical voice that sounds different from their own, and these people are perfectly healthy, functioning normally. It's just how their inner world is organized.
That's 1 in 5 people walking around with what is technically a voice in their head that isn't theirs, and they're fine. That's wild.
It's culturally mediated, too. In some cultures, hearing the voice of an ancestor or a spiritual figure is considered normal and even desirable. In Western psychiatric frameworks, we've historically been quicker to pathologize voice hearing. But the line between normal variation and pathology is more about distress and dysfunction than about the mere presence of voices.
The same phenomenon, hearing a voice, could be a religious experience in one context and a symptom in another.
And that doesn't mean clinical auditory hallucinations aren't real or serious. They absolutely are. But there's a spectrum, and most of us are somewhere on it in ways we don't talk about.
Let me ask you something. When you're reading, do you hear the words in your head?
And the speed of my reading is basically limited by how fast I can say the words internally.
But I've read that some people don't do that. They can absorb text without subvocalizing. And those people tend to read much faster.
That's the speed reading dream, right? Eliminate subvocalization and you can supposedly read thousands of words per minute. The evidence on whether that actually works for comprehension is mixed at best. But it does point to another dimension of variation, the degree to which inner speech is tied to the motor systems involved in actual speech.
What do you mean?
When you subvocalize, there are tiny micro-movements in your larynx and tongue. Your brain is sending the same motor commands it would send if you were speaking out loud, just at a lower intensity. For some people, inner speech is deeply embodied. It's almost like whispering to yourself without making sound. For others, it's more abstract, less tied to the physical apparatus of speech.
Some people's inner voice is basically muted talking, and other people's inner voice is something else entirely.
And this connects to broader theories of cognition. There's a debate in philosophy and cognitive science about whether thought is fundamentally linguistic or whether language is just one way we express thoughts that exist independently of language.
The language of thought hypothesis. Jerry Fodor and all that.
Look at you. Yeah, Fodor argued for a mental ease, a language of thought that's more fundamental than any spoken language. The idea is that when a thought occurs to you, it first exists in this abstract symbolic system, and then it might get translated into English or Hebrew or whatever your spoken language is.
Which would explain unsymbolized thinking. Those thoughts exist in mental ease and just never get translated.
That's one interpretation. But there are other views. Some people argue that language actually constitutes thought, that having language gives you capacities for certain kinds of thinking you simply couldn't do without it.
That seems testable. What happens to inner experience in people who are deaf and don't learn sign language until later in life?
This is a fascinating area. People who are congenitally deaf and grow up with sign language often report having inner signing rather than inner speech. Their internal monologue is visual motor. They see themselves signing or feel the signing movements rather than hearing words.
It's not that they lack an inner monologue. It's that their inner monologue takes the form of their primary language.
And people who grow up bilingual often report that their inner speech switches between languages depending on context. If they're in an English-speaking environment, their inner voice might be in English. If they're speaking Spanish all day, it shifts to Spanish. Some people even report thinking in a language they're not fully fluent in after immersion.
I've experienced that. After spending enough time in a Hebrew-speaking environment, my internal narration starts defaulting to Hebrew for certain things, usually practical stuff. Where are my keys? Becomes Ifua Hamaftikot.
That tells us something important. Inner speech isn't a fixed trait. It's responsive to environment, to context, to what you've been doing. It's a cognitive tool that adapts.
Which brings me to a question I've been sitting on. If inner speech is a tool, what is it for? What's the function?
Self-regulation is a big one. Children use private speech to guide their behavior. Don't touch that, it's hot. And adults do the same thing internally, planning and problem solving. Working memory, we rehearse information verbally to keep it active. Emotional processing, talking ourselves through feelings. And self-reflection. The internal dialogue is how many people construct their sense of self.
If someone doesn't have that tool, or has it in a very different form, does that change how they do all those things?
This is the million-dollar question, and the research is still emerging. There's some evidence that people with less inner speech might rely more on visual thinking or other modalities for the same functions. A person might not say, "Don't touch that, it's hot," in their head. They might instead have a vivid mental image of their hand getting burned.
Or a feeling of aversion that doesn't get verbalized.
And it might work just as well. We shouldn't assume that inner speech is the only way to accomplish these cognitive tasks. It's probably the most common way in literate, language-heavy cultures, but it's not the only way.
There's something almost unsettling about the idea that the voice I've been talking to my whole life is optional equipment. Like discovering that some people don't dream, or don't have a mind's eye.
That's aphantasia. The inability to form mental images. And it's a great parallel. For most of human history, nobody realized aphantasia existed because people who had it assumed, "Picture this in your mind," was a metaphor. And people who didn't have it assumed everyone could visualize. It took a 2015 paper by Adam Zeman to really bring it into public awareness.
I remember when that broke. Suddenly a chunk of the population discovered they'd been missing a feature they didn't know existed. And another chunk discovered they had a feature they thought was universal.
The inner monologue conversation is following the same trajectory. It's probably been happening quietly in psychology departments for decades, but the public conversation is only now catching up.
Let's talk about the emotional dimension. Daniel mentioned that sometimes thoughts race, sometimes they're quiet during meditation, sometimes they drive you crazy. There's a relationship between inner speech and mental health that seems important even outside of clinical diagnoses.
Rumination, that repetitive, negative inner speech that goes in circles, is a major feature of depression and anxiety. But everyone ruminates to some degree. The difference is partly in content, partly in intensity, and partly in how much the person believes the thoughts.
That last part is key. Cognitive behavioral therapy is built on the idea that you don't have to believe your automatic thoughts. But if your inner voice feels indistinguishable from you, that's a hard distinction to make.
This is where mindfulness and meditation come in. The goal of a lot of meditation practices is to observe your thoughts without identifying with them. To notice, oh, there's a thought about work, without getting caught up in it. That skill is trainable, and it changes your relationship with your inner voice.
I've noticed that after meditating, my inner voice doesn't go away, but it feels less. Thoughts pass through without hooking me.
There's neural imaging research on this. Long-term meditators show reduced activity in the default mode network, the brain system associated with mind-wandering and self-referential thought. Their brains are literally less prone to the kind of chattering inner monologue that most of us live with.
You can change your inner experience through practice. That's hopeful.
Very much so. But it also raises a question. If you can reduce inner speech through meditation, and some people naturally have very little inner speech, are those people walking around in a kind of natural meditative state?
I doubt it. I guess they've just got other forms of mental noise. Visual noise, emotional noise, unsymbolized noise. The content is still there, just in a different format.
That's probably right. The mind finds ways to be busy regardless of modality. A person without inner speech might still have racing visual images, or intense emotional surges, or a sense of mental crowding that's hard to describe.
Which makes me think about the broader question of what a thought even is. We did a whole episode on that earlier today, but it hits differently now. If thoughts can be words, images, feelings, or this unsymbolized thing, what's the common thread? What makes all of those thoughts?
That might be the deepest question in cognitive science. At some level, a thought is just a pattern of neural activation that represents something, but that definition is so broad it's almost useless. The more useful approach might be to stop trying to define thought as one thing, and instead recognize that thinking is a family of processes that share some family resemblances.
A Wittgenstein move. I like it.
Within that family, inner speech is just one member, an important one, especially in cultures that prioritize verbal reasoning and literacy, but not the whole story.
Let me ask you something practical. If someone's listening to this and realizing their inner experience is different from what we're describing, should they be concerned?
Not at all. The range of normal is enormous. Unless your mental experience is causing you distress or impairing your functioning, variation is just variation. Some people have constant inner speech, some have none, most are somewhere in between. Some people think in full sentences, some in fragments, some in images, some in abstractions. It's all part of the human cognitive repertoire.
That's reassuring. But I do think there's value in knowing your own mind more precisely. Understanding how you think might help you work with your strengths rather than against them.
If you're someone with very verbal inner speech, writing things down or talking through problems might be especially effective for you. If you're more visual, diagrams and spatial arrangements might work better. If you're more abstract and unsymbolized, you might need to experiment to find what external tools help you capture those pre-linguistic insights.
It's almost like we should be teaching this in schools. Instead of assuming everyone's mind works the same way, help kids discover their own cognitive style.
There's a whole field of metacognition, thinking about thinking, that's starting to influence education. But we're still in the early stages. Most people go through their entire lives never having a conversation about what their thoughts actually feel like from the inside.
No, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Octopuses have 3 hearts, and 2 of them stop beating when they swim.
What can listeners actually do with all this? I think the first thing is just to pay attention. Not in a obsessive way, but occasionally check in with your own mind and notice what form your thoughts are taking. are you narrating?
If you want to go deeper, try something like Hurlburt's method on yourself. Set a random timer a few times a day, and when it goes off, immediately note what your mental experience was in that exact moment. Not what you were thinking about 5 seconds earlier, not what you think you should have been thinking, just capture the raw data.
You'll probably be surprised. I tried this after we first talked about doing this episode, and I was shocked by how much of my thinking isn't verbal. I would have told you my inner monologue is constant, but when I actually checked, there were big stretches of unsymbolized processing I'd never noticed.
That's the observer effect working in reverse. Instead of changing your thoughts, you're discovering what was already there. Another practical takeaway, if you struggle with a racing inner voice, especially at night when you're trying to sleep, there are evidence-based techniques that help. Cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia includes specific strategies for quieting verbal rumination.
What kind of strategies?
One is called cognitive shuffling. Instead of thinking in coherent sentences, you deliberately think in random, disconnected words or images. Think of a word, bedroom, then picture something starting with each letter, B, bear, and so on. It disrupts the narrative thread that keeps rumination going without requiring you to suppress thoughts entirely.
That's clever. It's like jamming the speech channel with noise so the anxious content can't get through.
Another approach is scheduled worry time. You give yourself 15 minutes a day to worry deliberately, in words, out loud, or on paper. When worries come up at other times, you note them down and tell yourself you'll address them during worry time. It sounds too simple to work, but the evidence is solid.
For people who want to develop more distance from their inner voice, meditation is the obvious path. But even just labeling thoughts as they arise, planning, remembering, worrying, can create some space.
The labeling technique comes from mindfulness-based stress reduction, and it's remarkably effective. You're not trying to stop the thoughts, just categorizing them. It shifts you from being immersed in the thought to observing it.
One more practical note. If you're a parent or teacher, pay attention to how kids use private speech. That out loud self-talk that young children do isn't just cute. It's a window into how they're learning to regulate their behavior and emotions. Don't shush it. Let it run its course.
That's such a good point. Vygotsky saw private speech as a crucial developmental stage, and suppressing it might actually interfere with the internalization process. When a child says, "Careful, don't spill," while carrying a cup of water, they're building the scaffolding that will eventually become silent self-regulation.
The kid muttering to themselves in the corner isn't being weird. They're assembling their inner voice in real time.
And knowing that, you can actually support it. Narrate your own problem-solving out loud when you're with young kids. I can't find my keys. Let me think about where I was when I last had them. You're modeling the kind of self-talk that eventually goes internal.
That's a lovely thought. We're all walking around with an inner voice that was shaped, in part, by the voices we heard as children.
That inner voice, in turn, shapes how we experience our own lives. It's the narrator of our autobiography, even if it's an unreliable one. Understanding that it's just one way a mind can be organized, not the only way, not the default way, is genuinely liberating.
It makes me wonder about the future. As we develop better brain-computer interfaces, better ways of observing and measuring inner experience, we're going to learn things about the variety of human consciousness that we can barely imagine right now. The inner monologue might turn out to be just one small island in a vast archipelago of cognitive styles.
That's both humbling and exciting. We're still in the early days of understanding our own minds. The fact that we can have a conversation like this and realize how much variation exists among perfectly normal, healthy people, that tells us we've barely scratched the surface.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumentop for producing, as always. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com, and if you've got a question about the weird landscape inside your own head, send it our way. We'll be here.
Until next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep.
The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.